Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. So let's start with some articles from AARP, the magazine. Real People, Woman of Letters. Vet Fannie McClendon's World War II unit receives long overdue recognition. When I was in high school, my favorite subjects were history and geography. I just couldn't wait to see the places I had read about. That's why, after I graduated, I enlisted in the Army. My mother didn't think it was a good idea, but I had a mind of my own. The military was still segregated at that time, and I was assigned to the first all-black, all-female United States Army unit to be deployed overseas. We served in Europe during World War II as the 6888th Central Postal Directory Battalion. We had an important job to do. Our soldiers in Europe weren't getting their letters and packages delivered. There was a backlog of 2 to 3 years, and mail is the thread that keeps our service members connected to their families back home. Our battalion was determined to bring some cheer and hope to our soldiers. So when we first arrived in Birmingham, England, we worked in round-the-clock shifts 7 days a week, and in only 3 months, we cleared up a backlog of around 17 million pieces of mail. That was 2 times faster than the Army thought we could get it done. During the war, we also served in France, and after the war, I joined the Air Force. I was in line to become a squadron commander, but every time I got assigned, they would send me for more training. But that's all right. At training camp in Cheyenne, Wyoming, is where I met my late husband, Roy, and eventually I did get that promotion. I became the first woman to lead an all-male squadron in the Strategic Air Command. All told, I was in the service for 26 and a half years and never thought about getting any special honors. I am amazed that I'll be receiving the Congressional Gold Medal for our service during the war. Every member of the 6888th will receive one. I'm only sorry that out of more than 800 battalion members, only a handful of us are still alive to see this day. I'm grateful to have lived an amazing life, but what matters most is what all those letters represented, staying connected to the ones we hold dear. And this was by retired Air Force Major Fannie Griffin McClendon, 101, who lives in Tucson, Arizona, and she told this to Robin Weston. Now, the next special person we're going to look at is, the story is entitled Keeping the Boats Afloat, How Retired Private Investigator Faye Farron Became the Ferry, F-E-R-R-Y, Godmother of New Orleans. In 2001, I sold my detective agency in San Francisco and moved to Algiers Point, a quiet New Orleans neighborhood that was a short, free ferry ride from the French Quarter. A lot of my new neighbors worked in the hospital or in the hospitality industry across the river, and they depended on the ferry to get to work. After Hurricane Katrina, the State Transportation Department announced it would be cutting the ferry hours, stopping service at 10 p.m. That would have left a lot of restaurant workers unable to get to their shifts. So I decided to rally some neighbors to protest the cuts, and we got the state to back down. That's how our nonprofit, Friends of the Ferry, got started. Fast forward to 2013, and the ferry system itself was on the chopping block due to budget cuts. I just knew it had to be saved. The service had been started in 1827 to connect the two oldest neighborhoods in the city. So it wasn't just a practical way to cross the river. It was our history and our heritage. I started using my detective skills to get access to public records so we could arm ourselves with information. A reporter friend advised me to turn our protests into spectacles. When the news media comes out, she said, public officials come out too. So we protested in crazy costumes, Some of us dressed like rubber duckies. I would wear a midnight blue dress and a tiara, the fairy godmother. It's New Orleans. There are always costumes around. We would talk to people about what losing the ferry would mean, how it would increase traffic on the bridges. We went to the state legislature every week for 6 weeks while the issue was being debated. The ferry came within 2 weeks of being completely defunded, which was scary, but in the end, a solution was found. The state turned operations over to the city, which started charging a fee of $2 per ride for everyone over 2 years old, or $1 for seniors and disabled people. And the new management bought new ferry boats. The old one looked like a riverboat and was in bad shape due to deferred maintenance. It rumbled so loud you thought it might explode in the middle of the river. Now the ferry is smaller, silent, and uses so much less gas. It's also faster. It only takes 3 minutes to cross. Being the fairy godmother is an ongoing volunteer job for me. I organize an annual fundraiser for the ferry, and I cook dinner for the crew on Christmas Day. I field dozens of calls a week from people with questions about ferry service, and I'm working with the management activists and public officials to expand high-speed ferry service in New Orleans. We could be so much more connected. People often run into roadblocks and think, that's it, it's over. But I've learned that as long as you keep trying, you're still in the middle of a process. If you want to win, just keep going. So this, again, was from Thay Farron. She's 73 and is the founder and president of the nonprofit Friends of the Ferry in New Orleans. And she told this story to Sharon McDonald. Now let's look at an article from AARP, The Bulletin, under the heading of Your Money, Financially Speaking. Is it time to sell your house? Cashing out in a hot market isn't always a good idea. Some people I know are playing a new game of sorts, going on real estate websites every few weeks to see how much the estimated value of their house has risen. Home prices have surged for 2 years now. The average increase over that time is about 30%, and the gains kept coming this spring. Those of us who have owned our homes for years can probably find a buyer easily and net a lot of cash for our retirement. So should we take the money and run? If the market craters later on, or maybe we'll be sorry we didn't sell now. But then, where to live next? That is the crux of the dialogue playing out now at our kitchen table. People are looking at prices as the reason to sell. But they have questions about where they are going to go, said Linda Chaletsky, an agent who works in the Washington, D.C. metro area. There's not a lot of choice out there. There are good reasons to sell right now, but it may still be the wrong time to make the right move. Let's break it down. The one thing that you should absolutely not do is to try to time the market, said Rachel Elson, a financial advisor with Paragon Wealth Management in San Francisco, where the market is hot, hot, hot. If you sell, thinking that you are going to hit the market top and rent until house prices fall, you might end up renting for life because home prices continued to rise while you were out of the market. That's what happened to an acquaintance of Elson's who sold his home a few years ago. He's still renting. Nobody really knows or should try to predict where the housing market is headed. Higher mortgage rates, which were rising sharply in March and April, could dampen housing projects or have little effect. One thing not to plan on is a relapse of the sickness that sent home prices down 21% between 2006 and 2011. Before that crash, the housing market had been propped up by mortgage lenders offering zero documentation, zero down payment mortgages to anyone and everyone. The situation is very different now, says Joel Kahn, Associate Vice President of Economic and Industry Forecasting for the Mortgage Bankers Association. Households have a lot of savings. The bulk of home buyers are putting down decent down payments. There's no big subprime market like we saw in the earlier 2000s. And mortgage delinquencies are down sharply. All of that makes a housing debacle far less likely than it was in 2006. After the sale. Another crucial part of deciding whether to sell, figuring out where you're going to go next. If you still love living in your home, don't want to give up your neighbors, and haven't thought through your next stage, stay put. While your house has risen in value, so have all the other homes in your neighborhood. By the time you sell your home, move to a smaller one, and fix it up a little, you may be disappointed at how little money you actually walk away with. If you have already been mulling a move to a cheaper region, to be nearer to your kids, to life with fewer staircases, now could be a great time to sell and buy so the market doesn't slip away from you. Now is also a good time to sell if you don't have much savings and need the equity from your home to fund your retirement. You can do away with property taxes and maintenance and exact the equity and invest it and live on it, she says. But, she adds, you have to get comfortable with renting. Not sure what to do? It's never too early to start exploring the market to see what else is out there for you. And, Chaletsky suggests, you might start on the clean-out and home improvements that will make selling your house easier once you are ready. It's always the right time for that. And I do have to comment that this article is a bit old, as housing market has definitely changed lately. Now, from the world of sports and also from AARP, the Bulletin, we have a Q&A with Lee Trevino, still taking his swings 50 years after a stirring British Open with legend Lee Trevino on staying in the game. You grew up poor on a cotton farm in Texas. Who encouraged you to escape? No one. I raised myself. I was just lucky. The good Lord watched over me. When I see him, I want to hear him say, I gave you a lot of talent and you took advantage of it. Even if you were not dealt the best cards, you can still win the hand. I did a lot of bluffing along the way. Talk about joining the Marines. It took a poor kid off a farm. He was probably going to be there the rest of his life. The Marine Corps gave me knowledge of the world. I went to Okinawa, Taiwan, and the Philippines. It gave me an education. You could go to West Point and not learn what I did. Who helped you the most, personally? The greatest thing that ever happened to me was my third wife, Claudia. I can honestly say you wouldn't be talking to me if I wouldn't have married her. She is the first person I have ever been around who wasn't a yes man. The worst thing for an athlete to do is surround yourself with yes people. She said from day one, words have consequences. After 38 years, she treats me the same as on our first date. Do you feel welcome on the PGA Tour? I felt like a stranger. I didn't have the pedigree. Those guys played high school and college golf. It was like a reunion for them. I went straight from my job on the driving range to the Pro Tour. They didn't know me. I beat Jack Nicklaus in the 1971 U.S. Open playoff, but I still felt as if I didn't belong. The next week, when I was playing in a Pro-Am, the late golfer Bob Golby hugged me. Man, we were really proud of you beating Nicklaus, he said. I felt, for the first time, that I belonged. Who was your fiercest competition? Gary Player. At 5'7", he was a killer. You didn't want any part of him. He stood toe-to-toe with Arnold Palmer and Nicklaus. You quickly were embraced as one of the sport's most popular ambassadors. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I worked at a driving range and a golf course. Public relations was important to me. I wanted to make people happy. When I went on tour, I felt like I owed fans something. They pay to watch you. The only way to show appreciation is to have a little dialogue with them. 50 years ago, you won the British Open. What do you remember about that? I was defending champion, so I enjoyed myself. We had six couples, and we rented a castle. We had a ball. We bet on me to win with the British bookmakers. I opened at 14-1 odds. I didn't play real well in the first round, so the odds went up. We bet again. After I won, we had a party at the castle. I played good and bad that week, but I chipped in four times. You knew Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods. Who was the better golfer in his prime? I don't think Tiger would have handled Jack if both were using today's equipment. Both are extremely talented golfers, very dedicated. Jack was a lot stronger than Tiger. He would have hit the ball so much further than Tiger. In his day, Jack could hit the ball more than 300 yards with the old equipment. Today, he would have been chipping back on the par fours. What can we do to encourage more minority participation in golf? I started on the PGA Tour in 1967, and we had almost two dozen Hispanics and blacks. It's not going the way we would like it. Golf is extremely expensive. We have to find a way to make it affordable for young people. Price is never going to bother the white-collar guy. The PGA Tour and the USGA have junior programs for kids to learn how to play. But the problem is the cost, even on public courses. When I started caddying in 48, you could play a public course for $1.50. How did golf treat your body? I got hit by lightning in 1975. I lost discs in my back, ruptured ligaments in a thumb. I have a steel plate in my throat because I ruptured 6 discs in my neck. I have 2 steel rollers in my back. You live with pain. Regardless of how I feel, I don't have to go too far to find somebody that is a hell of a lot worse off. At 82, how do you stay physically active? Suppleness is number one. You have to be able to bend down and touch your toes. You have to be able to put your socks on. You have to stretch. Ride a bike a little. Lift light dumbbells. I don't have a lazy boy in the house. Why? Because I would sit in the damn thing and never move. What keeps you mentally sharp? I stay away from people. If you are in a crowd, there is a tremendous amount of negativism. Many of them don't have a clue as to what they're talking about. I talk a lot too, but I absorb what people are saying. Some people just make up stuff so they will sound better. And this interview was by John Saraceno. Now moving on to AARP, the magazine, a special health report, medical breakthroughs that are changing lives now. The news is full of promising new developments that may one day lead to a brighter, healthier future. But for our annual survey of the latest medical breakthroughs, we decided to focus on game changers that are improving lives today. Each of these astounding new technologies and treatments is available now or in the near future to make your life and the lives of millions of other Americans better. Heart disease breakthrough. Smart stethoscopes for early heart disease diagnosis. And interestingly enough, we have a picture here of Charles Griggs wielding a golf, playing golf. And he is now free from heart health worry. Charles Griggs eats healthy most of the time and plays golf and basketball whenever he can. Yet he's long had a nagging worry about his heart. As an athlete growing up, I always seemed to get tired first, he says. I wondered if I had a slight heart murmur. Last summer, Griggs, 61, a public relations professional from Jacksonville, Florida, participated in a health screening, and one tool the doctor had on hand was a smart stethoscope, which can detect the slightest of murmurs. Griggs' heart was fine, but several people screened that day showed signs of heart disease. 5 to 10% of people we screen have some form of valvular heart disease or arterial or atrial fibrillation, says Antoine Keller, MD, a cardiothoracic surgeon and co-founder of HeartSense, a nonprofit project aimed at detecting heart disease and other risks in underserved populations. This stethoscope allows doctors to identify heart murmurs before they can be heard. It changes the paradigm for early diagnosis. Heart valve disease affects 8.5 to 13.2% of adults over the age of 65, boosting their risk for heart failure, stroke, and blood clots as valve flaps thicken and stiffen with age, weakening the heart's ability to pump blood. Early diagnosis can improve a patient's prognosis, but conventional stethoscopes often miss it, so people have no warning. In a 2017 British study of 251 older adults with no cardiovascular symptoms, regular stethoscopes detected just 32% of early valve problems and only 43% of more serious cases. The smart stethoscope, called the Echo Duo, is a stethoscope plus electrocardiogram, ECG. Cleared by the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, it amplifies heart, lung, and other body sounds up to 32 times, performs a single lead ECG, and analyzes the data on a smartphone app for subtle signs of heart disease, including heart murmurs and atrial fibrillation, AFib. The analysis uses machine learning algorithms developed with one of the world's largest suppositories of clinically validated heart sounds, says co-founder and CEO Connor Landgraf. In studies, the Echo Duo detected murmurs 88% of the time and AFib 99% of the time. Smart stethoscopes like the Echo Duo could help close gaps in the diagnosis and treatment of patients from low-income, underserved, and rural communities, Keller says. African Americans, for example, are 54% less likely than white individuals to be referred to a specialist for heart valve problems, and 14% less likely to have severely damaged heart valves replaced. Still, Keller points out, using smart stethoscopes to find these diseases is just one part of the larger solution. If you don't take care of your wellness, you'll have to take care of your illness. And we have a little brief here. 3D view of coronary arteries. For people with chest pain, shortness of breath, or signs of heart blockage, an FDA-cleared test called HeartFlow FFRCT analysis can provide a three-dimensional look at the arteries of the heart without an invasive imaging procedure. Studies show the test can help identify who does and doesn't need more invasive tests and treatments. Now, under the heading of vision, breakthrough eye implants for age-related macular degeneration. When Melinda Roth, 63, tried to read the eye chart during a routine vision check in 2017, the view from her left eye had gone completely dark. I couldn't see anything, she says. I accused my doctor of playing a joke on me. A visit to the emergency room at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia revealed that Roth had age-related macular degeneration, AMD, the leading cause of severe vision loss in people 50 and older. In her left eye, Roth had wet AMD, a fast-moving advanced stage of the disease in which abnormal leaky blood vessels damage the macula, the part of the eye responsible for reading, driving, recognizing faces, and more. The standard treatment is regular eye injections of drugs to reduce blood vessel growth and leakage, but Roth's doctor asked her if she would like to join a clinical trial of an eye implant device that eliminates or reduces the need for injections by releasing a steady dose of the anti-VEGF drug, Lucentis, and she said, yes. The device called Susvimo is the size of a grain of rice. It was implanted in the upper part of Roth's left eye under the eyelid where it can't be seen or impede her vision. She received the implant but began her treatment by getting the monthly injections. After two or three shots, my vision began to improve, she says. It went from black to gray to as if there's a lace curtain in front of my eye. Once her implant was fully operational, she no longer needed two injections in her eye. though some people with the implant still get occasional supplemental injections to control blood vessel growth, says Carl D. Regillo, MD, chief of the retina service at Wills Eye Hospital and principal investigator in Susvimo's Phase 2 and 3 clinical trials. For Roth, it was a relief. While the shots didn't hurt, she said, nothing can prepare you for the doctor coming at you with a needle in your eye. The hardest part is keeping your hands down, not chewing them away. Roth still needs regular eye exams and six-month refills of the implant. The FDA approved the device in October 2021. Research shows it works as well as monthly injections, although it has a higher rate of side effects, including redness, pain, and light sensitivity, as well as infection, cataracts, and the erosion of the surface of the eye. The real value of the implant is in maintaining steady doses of the anti-VEGF drug. If there are gaps in treatment, you lose disease control, resulting in permanent vision loss for many of our patients. In the real world, patients often can't get into the office frequently enough to maintain the gains from their early visits. The patient may not be able to drive to the office themselves and may rely on caregivers. It becomes logically difficult and anxiety-provoking. The shots don't hurt, but they aren't pleasant. Now, some vision briefs. Eye drops that replace reading glasses. In a recent study, a statistically significant proportion of people using pilocarpine hydrochloride, or VUITY, eye drops, saw improvement in the blurry near vision caused by age-related lens changes that affect focusing and impact reading. Improvement in reading vision was seen as soon as 15 minutes and lasted through 6 hours. The drops were approved by the FDA in October of 2021. The drug improves near vision by decreasing pupil size. It may, however, interfere with night vision, so people who are using the eye drops should be particularly careful driving after dark. And contact lenses for itchy eyes. Allergy sufferers often have to skip contacts when their eyes water and itch. AccuView Theravision with ketotifen daily disposable lenses release the antihistamine to relieve itchy eyes, providing relief for up to 12 hours. The FDA approved them in February of 2022. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.